daring.
Gas prices. Whoa!
Sick and twisted, just how we like it.
Organic dog food.
Is it legal to be this insane?
Guess who I got to hang out with this weekend? You have any idea? My family.
Bruce Chandling's Excuse Me, America, Do You Mind?
Fast food. Here we go.
Psycho, screwy, and totally unbalanced, Chandling turns the stand-up stage into a mental institution.
Laser pointers? You know what I'd like to do? I'd like to take my laser car and drive it off of a laser cliff.
TBTL!
There are many ways to keep one's lips conditioned. I don't kiss, for example, 24 hours before a performance because kissing makes your lips mushy and we cannot have mushy lips and be a champion.
It's embarrassing and it's gross, but at least it's kind of funny.
You're hungry, you're confused, your face is streaked with dry tears, and you don't even remember when you started crying.
First of all, I'd like to see the chef face to face. These are the best Cajun chicken niblets I've ever had.
Shh, I get it. I know who you are. It's been explained to me. I'm into it. Let's talk.
All right, hello, good morning, and welcome everybody to a Monday edition of TBTL.
You're entering a world of pain.
The show that just might be too beautiful to live. My name is Luke Burbank. I'm your host.
I am extraordinary.
Coming to you from the Burbank Springs Broadcast Center, perched atop Alabama Hill in Bellingham, Washington, the Bay City. We've got a lot of energy on this Monday morning because those of you who follow me on Twitter may have seen a few months ago, I was freed from the tyranny of measuring the coffee grounds, the coffee that I'm putting into the coffee machine in the morning. I've just, for years of my life, carefully scooped it in there. And then one day I realized I kind of know about how much should be in there. I'm just going to just dump it right in from the bag of coffee. And that's treated me pretty well since I started doing that. Today, I would say probably twice as much coffee as needed to go into the filter went in, and I just said, let's just let her rip. And I will tell you something.
This song goes out to all the coffee lovers of the world.
I am so amped up on coffee right now.
I'm shaking.
I may have to go back to measuring the coffee is what I'm trying to say, because right now, this is going to be a high energy show probably for the first 35 minutes, and then I'm going to crash and go to sleep under the table here in the broadcast center. And then the Pod Pets will have to host the show with Andrew for the rest of the way. Which, I don't know, might be interesting. Honestly, the animals, I'm pretty sure that they've unionized. They're working in concert, and I don't stand a chance because they have me outnumbered. Usually the cat will come by and whine in the morning to be let out, or the dog will come and whine because she wants to go have her breakfast at like 5 a.m., This morning, they both showed up at the door or outside the bedroom door and were making noise. And I can ignore one of them, but they clearly figured out that there's strength in numbers. And I'm in big trouble here. The good news is we've got a fascinating episode of the show in store for you. It's episode 3184 in a collector series.
Let the fun begin.
Things are getting serious with this cyber training that we have to do.
It's your lucky day. You just found a USB flash drive in the parking lot.
For our bosses and our company back in Minnesota. We're getting emails about it now. There is a deadline, and the emails are even referencing that drop I just played for you. So we'll tell you what's going on with that. Also, the return of our hit segment, Skyjinx Ooh. Just because none of us are flying doesn't mean we can't bring you a Skyjinx segment about the sort of health safety measures or alleged health safety measures that will probably be instituted at airports across the country and the world, and if health security theater is going to become the new security theater.
Look it, it's plain and simple. It's bullshit.
I just took another sip of coffee while that drop was playing, and I have to tell you, I feel weird. Speaking of folks who, you know, have been known to feel weird on the show before, we got this guy, the longest-running Cobro of the show, known for his drawings of tall ships. He never misses the Sausage Fest. And even though he's been around for thousands of episodes, he still kind of learning the equipment.
What's going on, megaphone?
He is Andrew Walsh, and he's joining me right now from the Roosevelt neighborhood of Seattle, Washington. Good morning, my friend.
You zigged. I thought you were going to zag. When we were, during the sound check, you had a sausage drop lined up for me. But
yes.
Don't miss the sausage
Let me ask you this. You didn't change that up at the last minute because you heard a technical snafu about a minute and a half ago. Is that what happened there? Are you being passive-aggressive with your drops now?
Do you think I have the ability to do all of that on the fly? No. I did not. I didn't even know a technical gaffe had happened. What happened?
You didn't notice. Oh, good, because I was going to explain myself. The listeners might have noticed.
Did the music go away for a second?
Yes, right when you played the USB drive in the parking lot drop.
I did hear that.
The music went away. It had nothing to do with the fact that you were playing that drop. In fact, what I'm going to do here is, and I apologize, I am going to lose this music altogether. What happened was, do you recall on, I believe, Friday's show, I was trying to remember the competitor to Chef Boyardee. I was talking about how we were a snobby family growing up. If we're eating canned pasta, it had to be the best, and it had to be
right.
Chef Boyardee.
A higher class of canned pasta, I believe, was what you said. It was also the show title.
Maybe even the show title, yeah. And I couldn't remember, though, what the competitor brand was. I just could not think of it. And during your intro, I saw an email from Susan, listener Susan, New York, that says it was Franco American, and she included a link.
Oh, sure.
And I clicked on the link, and I didn't realize it was a YouTube video. And so I quickly like potted everything down because I was scared that the Franco American song was going to start playing in the background. When they're hungry at noon. When they pick up a spoon. Uh-oh, SpaghettiOs. What do kids say when they want to eat soon? So anyway, that is why I lost the music, because I accidentally almost started playing that. But I can put the music back on if you'd like.
I'm shocked to hear that you're not just sitting there in silent lucidity, just listening to me talk about the pets unionizing against me and how I made the coffee too strong this morning. I don't know how 3,184 episodes in, you're not still riveted by my spiel, TM, Mike Pesca. By my little patter there at the top of the show. You're watching retro junk. You're researching Franco. By the way, something about Franco American strikes me as, it's a division of the Campbell Soup Company, but it strikes me as a weird name. I mean, I understand that it's referring to a region, but wasn't Franco also a terrible dictator?
Yeah, but in Franco, in this case, does that mean France? And if so, why are we talking about pasta?
That's what I'm saying. The name Franco American. Let's see. I can't believe that we're just gonna. This is happening.
I will. While you look it up, I will say that I am riveted during your intros. I just have developed an ability to listen to you, and I opened up my email, which I hadn't opened since Friday. And man, it's been a busy weekend, and so I kind of got that feeling of like, whoa, I have a lot of emails to get through here. So my apologies. I was taking a little bit of a sneak peek during the intro.
By the way, you're absolutely right. I'm looking it up now. Franco-American, an American of French or especially French-Canadian descent. So was the argument – because I assumed that – I always assumed that, like, you know, Chef Boyardee, that comes off as – sort of Italian, I guess, although I think Boyardee, is that an Italian last name? It just, you know, it was pasta with red sauce, so I categorize it as Italian. And then Franco-American, I always assumed that was also Italian, but of course it's not. And then Franco was a dictator in Spain. So we've got just, it's a real, you know, multinational ball of confusion.
Yeah, write that down. A multinational ball of confusion.
Phil Collins, feel free to use that.
Superman, where are you now? Oh, I know that we got an email from somebody. I was trying to look this up during the show. Can I find it in the email? There are so many emails. But somebody wanted to point out that the Phil Collins video for Land of Confusion, those puppets that are in there. And I knew this. They were famous from being in other, like, commentary, social commentary things. And I think they had their own show on the BBC in the 80s. I think I'm looking for this email now. Did you already see that?
Well, I think I knew that, actually.
because we have talked about those puppets extensively, and I believe we got an email or an internet search figured that out like a year ago when we talked about it, because those puppets made quite the impression on me, and yeah, they were like a British thing, I think. And then I want to say also, there's now a version of it I've seen in like Russia or something. I've seen certain like internet videos of a similar style of puppet, and it's they're doing it in Russia or in one of the former like Soviet states as a form of satire now. So yeah, it's still an actually a going concern.
And also like puppetry, like when I went to New Hampshire, I was surprised to learn, I mean, I was young and not very plugged into the ways of the world, but I didn't realize that there was like this whole tradition of like protest puppetry in Vermont as well, which I think we've covered on the show before. No,
I'm sorry, just those words in that order, the protest puppetry of Vermont. just is like,
I almost worry that we have too many show titles now. Bread and Puppet is the name of the organization that I'm thinking of. They just celebrated in 2013. They celebrated 50 years of paper mache and protest, according to NPR.org.
So why was I'm looking at some Franco-American cans online now, okay?
Good, yep.
Franco-American macaroni and cheese.
Ew.
Franco-American spaghetti and meatballs. They, of course, were made SpaghettiOs. Franco-American spaghetti. Was the Franco-American Sonic the Hedgehog branded pasta and meatballs? Don't overpay, I would say, for your canned meatballs. I mean, that's what I've always said.
That's why we're a Chef Boyardee family.
Is the argument that this is supposed to be French-American or possibly French-Canadian-style cuisine? Why was it called Franco-American?
Oh, you don't know this? Because it was founded by Alphonse Berdeau, who immigrated.
It's crazy you just know this off the top of your head.
I'm surprised that you don't. That's what's weird. But I guess, I don't know, you were busy prepping your intro today while I was doing research for the show. I don't even know if that's a dig. I don't know. I started that sentence without really knowing how I was going to end it, trying to tie it all back to me not paying attention to you. But we'll scratch that. We'll cut that out. But let's see. He immigrated from France in 1880. So he's a French guy, and he started
But why is it not poutine?
I haven't gotten that far into the Wikipedia
French
yet.
Stuff. That's what I'm saying. It's just so odd that it's so heavily branded as being something that has a French influence. But then the food, at least this, maybe it was different in did he immigrate to, you said, Canada or the U.S.?
To the U.S., and he started the company. Okay. And then it was bought by Campbell's in 1915. So Campbell's is on the scene pretty early. But then it was still Franco-American in the 80s growing up. But then it looks like as of 2008, they got rid of, or maybe even prior to that, they just got rid of the Franco-American brand, which is why SpaghettiOs now just looks like it's a Campbell's brand, which is what confused me. So thank you, Susan, for setting me straight.
Again, somebody please, if you can, hive mind, get to the bottom of how it was that this brand that is purporting to be sort of French influenced was dealing almost exclusively, it would seem, in Italian food. Also, interesting that Campbell's buys Franco American back in the day for probably I don't know if SpaghettiOs existed early on. I don't know the history of the company. I haven't researched them the way you have. But, like, interesting that they would buy them, presumably for the brand, right? Like, because Franco-American was probably getting popular, and Campbell's was like, let's acquire this, and then we'll be able to play in that space. And then at some point, years later, they just phase it out, and they just go with Campbell's. Like, in other words, they bought the brand, they used it, I guess, for as long as it was useful, and then it was just gone. It was just, you know, like a fart in the wind.
I hate... to
feel
do
free
this,
to use that, Elton John.
I have to offer a correction, and I guess an apology to you and our listeners as well. I said that the brand no longer exists. The brand no longer exists as far as selling canned pasta, but as of 2008, the Campbell Soup Company continues to sell gravy under the Franco-American name, along with a small line of condensed soups.
How did that survive? There must have just been some hardcore fans of that gravy that were like, they started one of those like online petitions or something. Because I like that you're eliminating, you clearly made the decision from a branding standpoint that the Campbell's brand is what is strong. So let's just fold it all in. Or maybe just the name SpaghettiOs. Of course, people know that. but you decide to leave a couple of gravies and condensed soups under the Franco-American banner?
In a certain way, it makes sense, though, because you do want that strong soup branding, and Campbell's doesn't have any of that, so why not call it Franco-American?
Right, exactly. You don't, I mean, I, for one, do not think of soup when I think of Campbell's.
Right. So what were you supposed to talk about today? Okay, we're 15
this
minutes.
This email that came in, you're not the only one who can multitask, Andrew, during the when the important work of the show is being done.
While I was reading Wikipedia, you were checking your email.
I was. Did you see this email that came in at 8:53 a.m. West Coast time?
I saw that an email came in, but I haven't opened it yet. It's from one of our supervisors, Lauren, right?
Yeah. Okay, wow. Okay, we're just going to put names out there. That's fine.
Is that okay?
This is a reminder that you will need to complete cybersecurity training by tomorrow, June 30th, which, by the way...
That's not right.
I think... No, we've got a little while on that one.
Oh, but I see, I see, I see. You and I always get confused by this. This is a calendar invite for June 29th, and so therefore we accept it. It goes on our calendar, and then it says, this is a reminder that tomorrow's the deadline. So that makes sense.
Right. Okay, so it's a notification that's letting us know that this is really happening. It's not going to slide under anyone's radar. It has to be done by the end of the month. This, of course, the cybersecurity training that we did would seem only weeks ago, but maybe that was actually a year ago, which famously birthed this audio drop.
It's your lucky day. You just found a USB flash drive in the parking lot.
Among other things. Because the only way you and I could emotionally process how frustrated we were by the training, Andrew, was to just... text each other. I mean, maybe even had an actual phone call, and then just capturing the audio so that we could ridicule it. The person who emailed us says, "Don't think you can get out of this by claiming you picked up a flash drive in the parking lot and it ate your computer." Which good. I have to say, I take this to be independent confirmation that everyone agrees that audio drop is bunk. Mm-hmm. Like, this is not because our colleague listened to that episode of TBTL and is making a sly reference just for us. This is because, you know, 4 out of 5 APM journalists agree that piece of audio is silly.
I also think, though, that is a trend outside. I mean, I've seen that memeified a lot of places, too. I think it's a very common thing in cybersecurity training that stands out to everybody. I don't even think it's like an American public media thing at this point. I don't know, but...
Really? So in other words, the it's your lucky day, you found a USB drive in the parking lot is a thing that has been lampooned more broadly than just this show and our listeners? I'm not being sarcastic with that.
Yeah, I don't think that it's your lucky day. I think it's very specific to that piece of audio. But I don't think we're the only people who are kind of making fun of the USB drive in the parking lot thing. There's a lot of memes and stuff about it. I mentioned it. Remember, this is kind of interesting, kind of. I got a note from the HR person at Cairo Radio saying, hey, look at your work email from here because you're hardly ever in here, but you do have to complete cybersecurity training for Cairo as well. But I also have not been invited to be, to do an air shift over there in months and months and months. And I don't know if they're really going to ever ask me. So I've decided I'm not going to do that. And I will, if they ever invite me to be back on the radio and somehow they say, oh, wait, you can't get paid because you didn't take this thing, which is a possibility. I could see it like going through payroll and something gets red flagged. But I'm like, I'm not going to take the cybersecurity hoping that I somehow work there again at some point.
Yeah, definitely not worth it. I would cross the bridge of the cybersecurity training after the bridge of them having you on air has also been crossed. I'm just on the subject. I was trying to Google around and figure out if this USB drive in the parking lot thing is broader than American public media. This is a sort of older article, but it's from a guy named maybe Eli or Ellie Burstein. Concerns about USB security are real. 48% of people do plug in USB drives found in parking lots. If you attend any security conference, you will inevitably hear pen testers boasting that they can break into any company by dropping a malicious USB drive in the company's parking lot. This anecdote is so famous that it was featured in the TV show Mr. Robot in episode 6. This left us wondering, does this attack actually work or is it merely a myth? To put the attack to the test, we dropped nearly 300 USB sticks on the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign campus and measured who plugged in the drives. We found that users picked up, plugged in, and clicked on files 48% of the times of the drives that we dropped. They did so quickly. The first drive was connected in under 6 minutes. This blog summarizes how we ran the study, highlights of key findings, et cetera, et cetera. That's actually amazing. That's an interesting experiment.
I don't think it's surprising, though. There's something very tempting about it. And in fact, of course. Like, you
also
know,
if you scrawl SEX on the on the thumb drive crudely, I'm plugging that bad boy in immediately.
Or this is definitely not dirty sex or something like that, then you also raises flags. I know that that's going to be isolated. I can cut it out before he cuts it out. Then nobody gets to hear it ever. But yeah, so I think
I'm fine taking that secret to my grave.
I think it's fine.
Well, a few times I agree with you editing the
You don't wait, hold on. Do I have the ability to play it back immediately for you over and over and over? But yeah, so that's why I think that you and I have probably both made that joke in front of Lauren before. I already said her name before, so I'm not hiding her identity anymore. Although I noticed that you're
I wanted to have the ability, if I needed to, gently roast her, but that's now been it's been taken away from us by your lack of anonymizing.
Well, I mean, is there a lot to be roasting? I mean, so far,
no, but I just like to have the option,
right? Okay, down the line,
to just. Yeah, you know, I never know where my muse of creativity is going to take me, and sometimes, you know, it moves into the arena of gentle roasting.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess you have to stand by your words. So make
well,
it a good
roast.
Well,
this is why I didn't say your name for the first 1,200 episodes you were on the program. I wanted the ability to gently roast you.
Actually, I was on the program 1,500 episodes in. You didn't introduce me until the 1501 episode.
Yeah, that was very intentional. But I guess you're right. Well, let me say this. Funnily enough, I'm complaining about the cyber training, which of course is a silly thing because we're lucky to have jobs right now, and we're lucky to be safe in the world, and let's not lose sight of that. But also, it did kind of work on me. That silly piece of audio. It's your lucky day. You just found a USB drive in the parking lot. I can tell you that at this point in my life, if I found a USB drive in the parking lot, I would not plug it into a computer. And 2 years ago, I probably would have.
Yeah, do you remember even the secret? I mean, this isn't the same as finding one, but when the Secret Service apprehended the woman at Mar-a-Lago, who is now, do you know who I'm talking about? She's facing charges of being a spy. I cannot remember her name, but they confiscated USB drives from her and they plugged them directly into their government computers. Do you remember that headline?
I don't remember that headline, but I am unsurprised because they probably haven't taken the APM training, which
yeah,
we
exactly.
all know.
Exactly.
I've been getting nice feedback from people that work for Microsoft that have to watch the security training that I'm the host of, but I wonder if they're just doing that just to be nice to me because I mentioned it on the show the other day. But I would say that I can honestly say that I think, and I've said this before, the one that I was part of, and this is through no fault of my own. It has to do with my friends Graham and Kurt and their really good writing and then just like the way that they're shot. They're way less soul-crushing than the one that we have to do. And again, that's not trying to pat myself on the back. That's because the people that made the had the concept for it had a funnier idea than like what we're dealing with on our work end.
Of course, like you said, we haven't taken it yet. It could be the one that you're in. We don't know.
Oh my God, that would be so great to just stare at my fat Irish face for however many hours long that sesh is. Do I get – because I recorded it, because I'm literally the person who said the words, does that mean I don't have to do it?
I'm thinking about this more from a perspective of, let's say, me, because – and I want you to know that I love you a lot, and I love doing the show with you, and I love talking with you.
This is never a good setup.
But
this is never a good setup.
If there's one thing about cybersecurity training that I can kind of deal with is the fact that at least it's a work-related activity where I don't have to listen to you, right? Like, it's a little reprieve from doing TVTL. Now, here I am. Oh, okay, good. Well, I got to do this thing. And it's 3 hours. Okay, I'll do it. And then it's like Luke Burbank spoofing. I'm like, oh, good.
Probably.
Here we go.
Somehow working in, like, my four jokes.
Yeah.
I think, honestly, there was a moment when we were making it that, or there was an idea that it would be kind of funny to have me improvise. I have this weird reputation as somebody who's horrible at improv. I have this weird reputation as being somebody who can kind of improv, like in the, you know, sort of microclimate of like Seattle advertising, I guess you could say, or in the world of the Seattle low-level media that I engage in, people will kind of be like, oh, get Burbank. He'll be able to kind of like riff and make it work or whatever. But it's like I'm the worst at improvising, and it stresses me out. I've told the story so many times of when somebody went to bat for me and tried to get me the gig being the voice of Roundtable Pizza. Ironically, I eat Roundtable Pizza on practically a weekly basis. I've reinvested so much money into that company. They should hire me just because of my love of their product.
Is that a Franco-American brand?
That's actually Sino-American.
Okay. Makes sense.
Which is equally confusing. Mm-hmm. Sino refers to Asia, right? Would that be like Chinese-American?
I thought it meant China, but I don't know.
But it was the – I mean, again, listeners know this story. I don't have to belabor it, but – this ad agency, I lived in LA at the time, and this ad agency, I can't remember if I was in New York or LA. I was in some place, either New York or LA, and everyone was gathered in the other place. And they rented a studio for me to go to in whatever city it was I was in, and they had a camera there. This was big technology back then. And it was, they brought in all the Roundtable Pizza executives, and this was supposed to be my big thing, where I was supposed to do this like Roundtable guy voice. And then after I did it the first time, they said, the agency said, okay, just turn the script over and just give it that Luke Burbank magic. Like as if I was going to wing one Robin Williams style. And it was, I could have died, Andrew. All I did was the same script, just louder. Like that was how I improved. Good. I had nothing. Because, to improvise like that way is to be okay with looking silly when it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And that is... that to me, I would rather die. For as silly as I regularly appear on this show and am, the idea of going into a scenario where I know I'm going to potentially look foolish and exposed is very, very threatening to my sense of well-being. And I couldn't do it. And I could just watch these pizza executives look at each other, check their watches, and eventually just sort of get up and leave. And the ad agency, who would probably – at just this event had probably cost them a few grand. Just this was the audition. And they were so sure about that Luke Burbank improv magic that they were like, let's spend the money to convince the Roundtable executives this is going to work. And of course, it did not work at all. It was a complete failure. But it was funny because with the cybersecurity stuff, I think there was some thought, well, we'll have Luke improv it. And I think that like after I tried a couple of like trying to talk about, you know, fishing or some other thing in a like more casual, more improv way, they were like, actually, let's go ahead and stick to the script.
You know, we paid a lot of money for this script. You know, if
stay on script.
Going back to that Roundtable Pizza thing, if in the final version, whatever actor they hired ends up doing it slightly louder, I think you have a lawsuit on your hands. Because that means they stole your idea from the audition and then used it without paying you.
I think, yeah. I have to go back and look at those ads and see what they ended up doing or who they was the person supposed to be a knight, maybe? I don't know. There was the other thing that was similar to that was this local car stereo place. This is another famous story from my middling media career. This car stereo place in the Northwest called Car Toys. I used to do some of their ads where I just was like an anonymous – one time I was playing a quote-unquote skate punk. Was talking about speakers, but I got basically hired to be the new voice of that campaign, which was a big deal. Like it paid a lot of money, but it was to be a Van Wilder type, which I believe was a reference to the Ryan Reynolds character. They wanted a Van Wilder type talking about stereos, and it was as bad an idea as it sounds. It was soul crushing. I did it because I wanted the money. Like I did the audition and I basically just like, it's just the worst feeling ever doing it creatively. Like this is not what I should sound like. And then at the end, my agent went over to have the paperwork signed and they literally changed their mind in the time between when my agent left his office and when he arrived at the location to sign the contracts.
I'm trying. So I've never seen Van Wilder, but I think I know.
Nor have I, which might've been why they decided ultimately to dump me.
But
you're just weird.
I assume you did a very heavy French accent. I don't know anything about Van Wilder. You put on a mustache. Yep. No, like, I guess it's kind of like a sassy, like fresh in the way that your mom would use the word fresh, kind of slightly sarcastic, good looking, but non-threatening chummy guy.
It's the weirdest thing. I mean, this happens a lot when you see like the sheets for auditions. A lot of times it'll say, we're looking for a so-and-so type. And they'll, you know, list, I don't know, they're just trying to give you some context, I guess, but Van Wilder type might be the weirdest one. I think he was sort of like lovable frat boy.
Mm-hmm.
Sort
yeah,
of
that's
like
a better way
a guy,
to put it. I could see that.
A guy who's sort of, you know, he makes trouble, but he's coming at it from a, he's not a bad guy. He's just troublesome, but you kind of love him at the end of the day, and you want to buy some Blaupunkt speakers from him, I guess.
Why do I – sorry about the snort laugh. Why do I think Van Wilder sounds like – there's an easy answer to this. I really just can't think of it. Why do I think that – I hear Van Wilder, and I think of vampires. Why is that? Is it Van Helsing?
Because of the band Van Wilder Weekend.
Oh,
who I believe really rips off Paul
wow,
Simon.
Wow, I get it. I think it's Van Helsing, isn't it? Isn't that a vampire fighter or something? I really don't know.
I've
much
never
about
seen it, but he's definitely fighting. Yeah, he's fighting some kind of dark forces from another world. Van Helsing is. Yeah, I don't.
And probably a
know
historical
a lot about
character,
that
I'm guessing, too.
Yes, it has the mark of that. So, all of which is to say. I guess we got to do this cyber training before the end of this month, Andrew. So, you know, ziggle zag it. Let's get back at it.
Before we go to break, did you want to roast Lauren at all, our dear friend and colleague? Any zingers?
Hold on. Let me get into my Van Wilder persona. How would Van Wilder gently roast our colleague, Lauren? No, I think we should just go to break because it's already a half hour into the show. And then when we come back, we'll do these top stories and a whole bunch more, I am sure. I have been, Andrew, voraciously consuming television over the weekend and would love to tell you about a couple of shows that I'm into as well. Oh, and how I scooped the New York Times. This is the story of when Van Wilder scooped the New York
wow.
Times. It's all coming up in a moment on TVTL. Do you think anybody would be able to piece together what's going on here, what the reference is?
I think so. We have some smart listeners.
Yes, we do.
If you listen very carefully, you can hear vampires screaming in the background.
This is one of the few songs that Van Morrison wrote about car stereo systems.
Mm-hmm.
Well, man,
explicitly
I was obsessed
about
with
it.
This song.
Explicitly.
Right. I mean, Astral Week was... It was all kind of a metaphor about mm-hmm. car stereos.
Right, right.
I don't need to go on a long, underinformed jag about Van Morrison, but I do find him to be so interesting. He's one of those people in public life who you just universally hear bad things about as
yeah,
a human being.
Kind of bums
like,
you out.
Like, everyone who's ever dealt with him hates him. But... And there's his music is weird because this is that band, Them, that he was in. I love this song. I actually really like a lot of Van Morrison's music, but it's also some of it has been sort of like it's, you know, co-opted and it's weird. A guy who's made some really great music has also made some songs that I feel like are kind of like Brown Eyed Girl. Everybody loves Brown Eyed Girl. It's look, if someone's singing it at karaoke, I'm not mad, but it's like. I don't know. I have a lot of mixed feelings about Van Morrison.
What's going on with Brown Eyed Girl? Is it something lyrically that is on the edge? I'm trying to what's.
I don't know. It's just a little bit. It's just a little generic as a song.
Oh, okay. Because I was
like,
okay, it's not something that doesn't stand the test of time or something in there that seems.
No. It's okay. Not problematic as I can tell. It's just sort of like he. I mean, Van Morrison he's still alive, but he has done some really interesting, weird shit. Like one of the things happened. Was, you know, he had this record contract that he wanted to get out of, but he owed them, I don't know, like 30 songs or something. And so he just went to a studio in New York and recorded 30 songs in one day. And they're terrible. I listened to them. And it didn't even work. It didn't even get him out of the contract. He ended up, I think, using the mafia to get him out of the contract.
Oh, well, if just flooding them with content doesn't work, which is what we've been
yeah,
really going with.
Yeah, then get the mafia to
then
help
you. Then
you
get the mafia.
But then it's like he will regularly just like walk off stage if like he feels like his backup band is like not in the pocket or whatever. Like, he just regularly quits concerts. People will be like, people will pay thousands of dollars to go see Van Morrison because they love him, and then, you know, and travel distances, and then he'll just quit in the middle of the show because he's in a bad mood.
He just
seems like a terrible human, but he's also made some, to me, really cool music that I like a lot.
Yeah, I don't know him that well. I think I could be wrong. I think Sean DeTore, Japan's number one mixer, for those unfamiliar, is a big Van Morrison head. And every time I talk to him about it, I think, when I get home, I got to really dig into that back catalog. And then I always forget. Something flashy comes in front of my eyes.
Check out Astral Weeks.
Okay.
That's like kind of, that's like when he sort of was coming into his own. It doesn't really have any of the like big hits, but it's just like, I think Astral Weeks was the thing he made after he did, because Moondance was the one that's like got, you know, all of these very, very, you know, toe tapping hit songs on it. But the one he did before that, Astral Weeks, is way more kind of experimental, I guess you could say. And it sort of bridged like, just a bunch of, I don't know enough about different genres of music to try to like say something interesting about the kind of music Van Morrison was making, but I would say check out Astral Weeks.
Okay, yeah.
Let's see. I would say let's check out Top Stories too.
Hello and welcome to Top Story.
It's an interesting story I saw at slate.com by Natasha Frost. If you thought taking your shoes off at airport screening was bad, just wait for what's coming. And it's a very well-researched kind of long article, but it just goes into all of the stuff that's either already in place or being proposed for trying to keep us safe from COVID while flying, and how basically once that stuff gets enacted, it's probably never going to go away. Things like temperature checks and possibly like biometric or digital ankle bracelets. More than 45 countries have rolled out digital ankle bracelet tracking apps, which are likely to be either mandatory or strongly encouraged for air travels. Biometric scanning, people having to write down an address where they're going to be self-quarantining for 14 days. And then there's like allegedly surprise visits to those places. Like,
well, that can't go on forever. Right.
I would hope not.
Yeah.
You know, but like the other thing that's happening, as Natasha writes about in this article, is that the airlines don't really want to pay for it because it's going to be expensive. So now they're trying to put it on the TSA. But the problem is the TSA, they're not trained. I mean, look, no offense. I would argue that they're barely trained to do what they do already, which is, as I've called it many times, security theater. Now we're adding, they're supposed to also become like medical experts. Like the TSA is supposed to be figuring out, you know, if you're too sick to fly, you know, which seems like a problem to me. She points out in this article that like there's all kinds of things that could cause you to have an elevated temperature as you're going through security, cancer treatment, a urinary tract infection, or any other unrelated factors could also you know, have an elevated, what you're trying to explain. Can you imagine trying to explain to a TSA person that you have a urinary tract infection and that's why you're,
I can tell you from experience.
Your temperature is too high to get on the plane. She also points out that people of color are disproportionately affected by COVID, which means they could be disproportionately affected by these rules. If you're a person of color and you're trying to fly somewhere because you have a job obligation or an important family thing and you can't go, you know, that's an issue. Also, I was kind of heartened by this. There is some indication that airplanes are actually not that dangerous as far as vectoring, which it has to do. The risk is fairly small to begin with. Let's see. She writes in this talking about the air in the airplane because of its dryness. Between hospital grade air filters and extreme dry air, a plane in flight actually seems to be fairly inhospitable for the virus, at least compared to going out for dinner, attending a cocktail party, or even going to choir practice. There is some risk, especially in the terminal or during boarding, but it seems comparable to a bus, a train, or other crowded environments, none of which are likely to have greater security measures. There was a recent study that came out in a Canadian medical journal. On a 15-hour flight between China and Toronto, more than 25 people sat within 7 feet of a symptomatic passenger. Not one of them later tested positive for COVID-19. So that I found that mildly encouraging. That it's not an absolute that people are going to get it if they're on the airplane just because of those factors. But I'm somebody who's annoyed. I get annoyed at the stuff the hoops you have to jump through at the TSA regarding security, because my argument has always been I don't think it's really stopping anything. Although I guess haven't had that many terroristic attacks, so maybe it's doing some good. But it's weird how when I think about them taking temperatures and doing all these health things, it feels to me very necessary. Like I feel like COVID is so much more of an extant threat to my life than somebody bringing a shoe bomb on the plane, that my first thought is good. They should have those things out and they should be doing every invasive procedure they need to so that people on the plane aren't sick and getting each other sick. It's weird how that doesn't seem to bother me, but them making me take my toiletries out of my bag feels like a major violation of my privacy. Plus, I have a lot of hemorrhoid medicine in there too, which is embarrassing.
Yeah, and stuff for your UTI.
Mm-hmm. That's just a plant. That's just to make my cover story more convincing.
You put embarrassing things in your toiletry bag to cover up the real embarrassing things. It's like, which one do I really need? Nobody knows. Maybe none of them.
Would a person who doesn't have a urinary tract infection have this bottle of what look like Flintstones vitamins, except Flintstones is crossed out and it writes pee problem over it? Does that seem like somebody who doesn't have a UTI?
Yeah, I really hate getting my bag tossed going through security. Like, that's the worst of it for me. But for the most part, you and Genevieve early on were both kind of champions of the idea of security theater. And I was always like, I don't know. It's hard to kind of prove a negative. I don't know. I believe that there's some good to that. Maybe even just like this idea of if you have bumped up security, it's going to, deter people from trying things. I don't know. Like, it never really bothered me that much. I got to say, though, that moment where they now do the full body scan where you have to stand up like a criminal with your hands in the air, I do hate that like a lot.
Well, because one of the things we know about that is they see you naked.
Well, that's, you know what I mean? That's like their problem as far as I'm concerned.
Well, it frustrates me because it's like, I mean, I'm at the age where I really am like, hey, your funeral, right? If you want to see this dad bod in full bloom, I guess go for it. But it does feel that does feel sort of invasive to me. For a while, my way of standing up to it was gently and subtly exposing both middle fingers while I had my hands up.
Classic move, but, me too.
But then I kind of started to get worried that, like, they've seen that too many times. And then it's just like I would rather get to my flight than take a principled stand against the TSA. So I think stopped doing that because I'm just like, I don't – on the off chance that it's going to get me some grief from them and delay me. Oh, that's another thing. Like, historically or back in before all the COVID stuff, I tended to cut it pretty close for getting to my flight. I guess those days are over because now we're going to basically go through like a hospital, like an urgent care center to get to your flight to Denver.
Yeah, I do wonder what the long-term impacts of this will be. After 9/11, you heard a lot of people predicting that, everybody's just going to be going on road trips a lot more. But, I mean, people took to the air again pretty quickly. So I don't know. I'm sure we'll bail out the industry again, and then they'll jack up prices again, and they'll say we're no longer allowed to bring bags on planes. And it costs us an extra $500 to not bring a bag on the plane for some reason. And
right.
We'll just go on with our lives.
You have to bring a bag on the plane. If you don't bring a bag, there's a charge. But you have to trade the bag with someone else on the plane.
That's right.
And then you have to wear their clothes when you land.
That's
security and COVID reasons.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
In India, they have a national contact tracing app. Like, here's the thing. Contact tracing is the way to do this. If you do good contact tracing, which for the five people that aren't familiar, the idea is you track people much more closely. If someone were to go into a restaurant, they have to write down their name and email address. That way, if somebody at that restaurant on that night turns out to be sick with COVID, you can actually contact everybody who's been around that person, and then they can all quarantine. It's such a more precise tool than just everyone has to stay at home in their own houses. That's the bluntest way to handle this. And yet, a contact tracing app actually seems kind of great to me. There, you can be marked as safe in the contact tracing app. But on the other hand, and I wouldn't have said this before the current administration, I don't know if I want all of my info in some government app that I can be tracked. And I swear to God, I would not have said that under any other president. But this guy seems sinister enough that it could end up being a bad deal.
Yeah, I mean, that gets at a broader kind of a broader thing that I don't think we'd necessarily want to take the show here today. But it is interesting how this administration took people like me who are liberals who trust the government and now suddenly realizing, like, by having the government so bad, they've turned us into people who no longer trust the government. I mean, it's weird that you can just destroy an institution so that you turn people to your way of thinking. Like, look, you can't trust us. Oh, shit, you're right. We can't
it's
trust
so
you.
It's so nihilistic.
It really is. It's just so terrible. It's
yeah, we're going to make this. We're going to take the biggest dump ever on this thing, and then you won't like it anymore, even though historically it's been an important, like, way that this country has run and a way to actually try to advance causes that matter, be it the environment or other things. But we're just going to ruin it so much that now you have no faith in it. It's like,
right.
And then they win. It's so frustrating.
Like Ray, the post office, Ray, public education, right?
Dude, I have this guy who delivers the mail to our house who wears a headset radio. Like, I'm talking, like, you know, from, like, Heathcliff. Actually, I don't know what those – those might have just been regular headphones. But, you know, there was one of the characters on, like, I think one of Riff Raff's posse would always have
headphones. Like, the big headphones, yeah.
Was that Mungo?
I don't know.
Okay. But this is – what this guy's wearing is – an old school, like a radio that was also headphones.
Oh, cool. With a little antenna that comes up?
With a little antenna on it.
Oh, yeah.
Dude, I mean, I see this guy all the time. He's our main guy in this neighborhood. He's a sweetheart. I wave at him every day. I see him when I'm out on jogs and stuff. I'm dying to find out what he's listening to. I've never seen him without his radio headset on from like circa 1989. And it's just great to me. Like, it's just such a throwback.
And it must just make the most sense. He's clearly, like, those things don't plug into a cassette player or anything, so it's wireless, but he just wants to listen to the radio. I'll bet you $1 million he's, like, a talk radio guy, right? Because you're not listening just to, like, the greatest hits of the 70s, 80s, and today. I might have skipped a few decades in there. But, like, chances are he's, like, addicted to, I don't know, a sports station or a talk station.
Yeah, for some reason, I guess it's sports, but I mean, it would be tough for me if it was conservative talk radio, even though I once worked in conservative talk radio.
It would be weird
because he's just such a
if he's a mailman listening to talk radio that's talking about how the postal service should away. That would be interesting.
Oh, that's a really good point. Yeah, I don't know. Again, I can't get close enough to him now without endangering him to ask. But we have this very sort of just like friendly from a distance relationship. I wave at him. I mean, this happened early on in the pandemic, but you just start to realize that, like, the folks that are out delivering the mail are just – they're so essential to all of our lives right now, and I so appreciate what they've been doing. I mean, there's a long list of people who are just doing incredibly important things, you know, for all of us, but the post office is near the top of the list for me. The other thing that's crazy is the post office – remember it used to be like – it was a six-day-a-week thing. Well, now I see those folks out on Sundays too, because I think that has to do probably with they're probably delivering all this like stuff from Amazon. I don't understand how it all works, but you know the post office ends up delivering a bunch of stuff for companies that are private companies, but they're not using FedEx or UPS. They do use the USPS for a variety of reasons, particularly in rural places, because there's no profit motive to deliver. There's not enough people getting delivery in certain areas, but the USPS is tasked with delivering the mail to everybody that lives in this country. And so what happens is like Amazon will ship through the USPS because that's the only person that'll drive something out to God knows where.
Yeah.
And yet they want to abolish the USPS. It's like, what is really going on here?
And that's new. I think that Sunday delivery happened like in the past 5 years or so in the Amazon era, right? Because they did because of the glut of things being shipped. And like you say, getting them to their final destination is important.
Yeah, I'd never seen it before. And now it's not uncommon to see some overburdened postal worker driving around the postal truck on a Sunday with just like 8 million Amazon-related things in it. Mm-hmm. And my thought is like, damn, you guys used to get Sundays off. Now, I mean, there's probably some staggering of the schedule, but still, it's like, I don't know. It feels to me like, why don't we just let Sunday be a day of rest for everybody, including the postal service?
I mean, some people might be happy to have the work. I don't know.
I mentioned this a minute ago, but you know how I did that TV story about happy hours And you and I were kind of talking about how it felt a little behind the curve to me that we were actually doing it when we were doing it, because A, things were starting to reopen, and B, I think we all have some amount of Zoom fatigue. And you even were worried that you had kind of made me feel slightly, would you say, undermined or a little bit, like, which I didn't, by the way, but you were a little worried at some point that your kind of mild eye roll at the premise was had like gotten me down or something.
Well, I was talking with you frankly about it before the show, and I didn't really think about it much. And then when I was, I guess, ostentatiously not invited to the party that weekend, I assumed that maybe I offended you in some way.
Right. Well, wouldn't you know, I'm looking at the New York Times today doing a little recon for our show, and there's a huge story. It's actually from last week, but still it was well after we did our TV story, about Dante, the bar and cafe in New York City who are in my story, and about how they're doing to-go Negronis. So I actually take that, journalism. I actually beat the New York Times on this story.
But wasn't it... So your story was about two things. It was about people gathering for online Zooms and the takeout kind of the high-end cocktail.
Yeah, about, takeout cocktail culture and there. Also okay, people gathering for Zoom.
Gotcha.
So maybe the gathering for Zooms part was still a little behind the curve. But the talking about Cafe Dante and their Negronis in New York and that, you know, people can get them to go now, that is way ahead of T Magazine in the New York Times. Take that.
How do you feel about that? You know, so there is a little restaurant not far from here, a bar restaurant I used to go to during normal times called the Westie. And it's a type of place where I like it because often, like, if I'm going to get like a very late lunch or a very early dinner, especially if baseball's on, it's a place where I can go get a plate of wings and watch a game at the bar. The food there, oh, no, of course, it's the Browns bar as well. And the food
I've watched a Browns game with you.
Yeah. And it's fine. I always find the food to be fine, but always a little trying to punch above its weight a little bit too much. And, you know, I saw that they're actually open now, and I was like, it's not even tempting for me to go in there because the only reason I go in there is so that I can eat wings at the bar or eat something at the bar and watch a game. Like, I can't imagine going in there. Sorry, Westie people. I actually am a big fan of your establishment, but, like, of all the places that are slowly opening, I don't want to, like, kind of sit at a table at the Westie. Anyway, all of that is to say, before they were open, they had a big sign outside that said, you know, to-go cocktails and what have you. And I was puzzling that out with Genevieve a little bit, because I think Genevieve made a joke like, I have cocktails at home. I have all the mixings for cocktails at home. And I guess people were looking for ways, and people are looking for ways to make their at-home experiences kind of special, and it's more than just mixing a drink at your house. But I never quite got it, because even if I wanted to, like, say, okay, you know what, we're sick of being stuck inside, and we're the type of people who like to spice things up with, we're going to dress up and have a cocktail night at our house or whatever, like, that's fine. That's not for me, but, you know, I dig it. I would still prefer to, like, get some sort of a bartender book or go online and learn how to make the drinks myself. Like, to have them to go, I just cannot see the appeal of that at all.
Well, not to turn this into a long ad for that place in New York, Dante, but what they basically did was figured out ways to kind of make, not really shelf stable, but to pre-make these things so that they were exactly, they could actually be transported, but they would be exactly like the thing you would get there that they were making for you. And, like, whether it was this Negroni or some other things too, they actually really, they did all this kind of like science around it so that they could scale it up and pre-mix it and or give you these little components that then you put together and they magically make the thing exactly the way you want it. And I think for some people, it's just a comfort thing. It's like they liked going to the cafe. They liked having whatever the particular drink was. They liked eating this kind of food. They were the folks that own that restaurant were saying there's this like 90-year-old woman who lives above the restaurant. And every Friday she would come in to have her, like, you know, whatever specific meal she would always have and whatever specific drink she would always have. And that during quarantine, she's been ordering that same meal every Friday and they just, like, take it up to her. So I think for some people it's, A, something to do. Like, our friends have this great restaurant here in Bellingham called Saltine. And, like, it, you know, they're I think they're making to-go cocktails now and they're doing, you know, to-go food that we would then cook at the house, like lasagna and stuff. And It was just an adventure. It was like there was a point of the quarantine where there was so little going on that just the idea of driving to a place that you used to go to and contactlessly getting stuff from them that tastes like the stuff you would have in there felt like I had it circled on my calendar, you know, like Friday night, there will be lasagna. So I think that's probably part of what is exciting to people. Now, the Westie, again, peace and love, because I dig that place, too. Remember that real character of a Cleveland Browns fan who was like accosting us slash negging us slash encouraging everyone when you and I were watching that Browns game in the back room?
Yeah, she's I can't remember her name. Like, I've been seeing her for years because she's a hardcore Browns fan, and she used to be at the other Browns bar when it was in South Lake Union. I can't think of her name, though. It's not Barb, but she seems like a Barb.
Funny because she was so – wasn't she like trying to roast me about not being enough of a Browns fan or something? I just remember her being like right on the edge of being mad at us, but then also being very encouraging and having a kind of crazy life story. Anyway, I like the Westie too. I don't think that's where I would get my to-go cocktails from just because It seems like it's a fairly straightforward bar. If there was a bar like – there's like the Zigzag Cafe or Cannon or one of these places that's just like known for their incredible attention to detail – and I were into that kind of thing, I could see getting a to-go cocktail from a place like that, even if just to kind of have some sense of normalcy.
It would be funny if I got takeout shots of Jim Beam and a tall boy of Rainier or Miller Lite from Teddy's. Just like, are you guys still doing to-go service? Great. Fantastic.
I love it.
Fortnite Thermos.
I was so excited this weekend, Andrew, to realize that this TV show that I love on Epix, Get Shorty, it's like the TV version of, I guess, maybe the novels more than the movie. Of course, Get Shorty was a movie with John Travolta in it.
And Danny DeVito, right?
Yeah. I loved that movie, by the way. I thought it was really good.
I love the first one, too. I haven't gone back and watched it with a more of a modern eye, but in that kind of, like, I consider that to be the kind of, like, post-Pulp Fiction. Like, everybody's trying to capture that kind of magic of that pulpy, poppy. I mean, it's literally by a pulp writer, right? Elmore Leonard. So right. I remember that being pretty successful. The second one was terrible.
Get Shorter? Is that what the second one was?
It's close. I actually can't think of it, but it's something.
I don't think I watched the second one either. But this TV show, I can't remember how or why I started watching it. I don't watch very much fictional television anymore. I mean, there's the occasional thing that everybody's into, like Game of Thrones, that I'll watch. But like, there's just so much fictional television being created all the time. And most of it honestly doesn't work for me. Most of the time I'll start watching something and I'll just be kind of like, yeah, I don't know. But for whatever reason, this TV show. Oh, you know what? I think I was watching it flew home from Australia.
Yep. Absolutely. I was going to tell you. I know exactly when you started watching it, because I think it might have even been on the way to Australia when we were flying in a plane that had very – like there was a TV in front of you, but you had to – I don't think stuff was on demand, right? And so you were a little bit forced to watch something. And is that when you started watching it? It was definitely
that
trip.
Yeah, the flight out there, we were on an older plane where the entertainment system was just like 10 channels that were just playing movies. And then when they were over, they would start again. But you had to constantly try to like – they didn't have any indication of when the movies were over. So you'd have to just keep flipping around, but without spoiling the end of the movie, try to catch the beginning of the movie, which was, you know, kind of a fun game of whack-a-mole at 30,000 feet. Mm-hmm. But on the way home, we were on like the newest plane they had, and that one had all kinds of on-demandness. And I think Get Shorty was one of those things. And so I just started watching it. And it, you know, that feeling of like watching something on an airplane when it's actually pretty good and it's a long flight, that's as riveted as you'll possibly be.
Yep.
Probably ever. And so it got to me, and I powered through the first two seasons. And then last night at about – I was like about to go to bed. It was like 9:30 or 10. I was like, I should probably start to wrap things up. And then I just for some reason – oh, maybe because it was – I went to – for whatever reason, my TV system reminded me that I used to watch this show, Get Shorty. And I was like, I wonder if season 3 is happening. And there it was, all of the episodes, Andrew. And I'll be darned if I didn't watch about 4 hours of it. Because it's one of those shows for me that it, like, when an episode ends, I absolutely want to go to the next episode. And it was all I could do at like 1 in the morning to like physically break myself away from the TV. It's just, I highly recommend it to folks. It's got Chris O'Dowd in it. He's that Irish actor who's been in, like, he was in, I think, Bridesmaids. I think he played Kristen Wiig's boyfriend.
Sure, the police officer, yeah.
Yeah, which I thought that casting was so weird when I saw it. I was like, this is kind of a random Irish guy is like a cop boyfriend of hers. But I actually really love him. And then Ray Romano is in it, and he's amazing. And it's just such a good show. I highly, highly recommend it. But I cannot trust myself around it because I really will. Like, probably tonight I will watch 7 more episodes of it and then be done with it, and then I'll be sad because – I don't know if they're going to make a fourth season.
Well, that's actually – I'm glad to hear it because I do love that universe, and to know that they did a good job with it means that eventually I will probably watch that at some point. Whether or not we're before or after the 10,000th episode of this show, I can't tell you, and whether or not I can pronounce 10,000.
That's a hard word.
We've established that. It is really hard.
The other thing that I watched this weekend that blew me away – I don't know how this documentary escaped my radar – it's called Voyeur, and it's about – do you remember that whole thing about that Gay Talese book about the guy with the motel that he built the sort of like viewing catwalk above everyone's room so he could basically spy on his guests?
Yes. It was very disturbing.
It was a very disturbing story, and it premiered in The New Yorker, and you know, it was a huge New Yorker piece about this guy named Gerald Foos. And he was in like Aurora, Colorado, and he's just a kind of a terrible, terrible human, it would appear, and pervert, who bought this hotel so he could basically just like, you know, check out all of the guests through this system of vents that he built. And he would just spend hours and hours up there looking down at people who were, you know, living their lives in these hotel rooms. And the weird part was he reached out to Gay Talese in the 1980s, I think. Gay Talese wrote a book about sort of the sexual lives of Americans, and including, you know, swingers and all kinds of things. And this guy Gerald Foos read the book, and I think he was like, "Oh, Gay Talese is a kindred spirit." So he writes him a letter and basically says, "I have this hotel that I have basically designed for this one purpose." And so Gay Talese goes out and actually visits him and climbs up on the catwalk and actually kind of sees this with his own eyes that it exists. And then 30 years go by because this guy Foos doesn't want him writing about it because he doesn't want to get arrested or in trouble. And then eventually he sells the motel and he thinks the statute of limitations has expired. And so he decides to talk to Gay Talese. And then he writes this book. And then the controversy around the book was this guy actually believable? Because there's a bunch of dates that don't line up. And the book ends up getting kind of torpedoed right before it comes out. Because, again, you can't really rely on this dude's narration to be accurate or factual. What I did not realize, Andrew, was they were shooting a documentary about this too. And this dude, Foos, and his wife are in the documentary. They're interviewed extensively. It's really as much a movie about this guy, this voyeur, as it is about Gay Talese, but it's also about journalism. It's about their relationship. There are some iconic scenes in this movie. Like, at one point, this Foos guy is really mad at Gay Talese, but also he's older and he walks with a cane, and I guess he can't really go up and down stairs. So he has one of those seats that you sit in that will kind of take you down the stairs. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, yep.
And he goes at the top of the stairs. It's an incredible piece of filmmaking, even though it's, you know, a documentary. He goes and he gets in his chair that helps him get down the stairs, and he's just furious at Gay Talese that Gay Talese has included something about his baseball card collection in the New Yorker piece.
Oh, yeah, that's the thing to be embarrassed about.
He's just slow. I know, right? He's just slowly descending the stairs, yelling about Gay Talese and this baseball card collection as he moves ever so slowly in this chair. It's like if you wrote a fictional film and you wrote this scene, it would be one of the most genius scenes I've ever seen in a movie. And it's just happening in real life. It is a really, and it's, again, it is as much about Gay Talese as it is about this Foos guy. But if you're interested in journalism, if you've enjoyed the work of Gay Talese, or if you haven't, or whatever, if you just like things that are interesting, Voyeur, it's from 2017, is an incredible documentary.
I'm picturing Daniel Day-Lewis playing the just incredibly angry guy coming slowly down the stairs. Yeah. Wasn't there also, and I could be totally making this up, But wasn't there also pushback on the book because Gay Talese actually witnessed this and then didn't do anything for decades as far as turning it in?
Yeah, which I kind of think there's some – we've had Gay Talese on this show before, by the way. I'm a big admirer of his work.
That wasn't very up my alley. Weren't you trying to get him for LiveWire for this story and then the backlash happened, or am I misremembering?
Maybe that happened, but we had him on TBTL like a long time ago. I remember talking to him on the phone. It might have been for the anniversary of Frank Sinatra Has a Cold. I don't know. But he was on this podcast many years ago. And again, I've always, you know, since like journal, like it's like kind of journalism 101, usually, you know, new journalism. Gay Talese is always kind of at the top of that list. But I think it was weird to me to know that he knew this was going on and didn't alert the authorities. And then also the thing was the idea that there's no credibility to the book was kind of weird to me because it was like this guy is a fabulist to some degree, this guy Foose, but there is no way that he didn't do creepy shit. Like he had this thing built, Talese witnessed it. So let's just say the dates are off. At the core of it is a question of what this guy did, and it would appear that he really did it, and that's really upsetting. And yeah, I mean, there's even one point in the story where this guy basically he admits to having maybe created a murder. There was this couple, this young couple staying in one of the rooms, the guy selling drugs. This guy, Foose, is very upset about that because one of his kids had a drug problem, allegedly. So he goes in the room when they're not there and steals the drugs. And when the guy comes back, he blames the girlfriend. There's a fight. She ends up dying. Foose is apparently watching all of this and just doesn't intervene in any way, doesn't call the police. The woman, by Foose's account, ends up dying. Now, the weird part is they go back and they can't find any medical records related to this event happening. And this guy kept very copious notes. And there was nobody that died at that motel that day or even maybe that year. There was something that happened at a different motel like 2 weeks later, like not even one he owned. So there's all like why you would ever lie about that makes no sense because, I mean, but to the degree that Gay Talese that believed that it actually happened and did not seem troubling to him, or yeah, to the degree that he goes up on this catwalk and is himself watching people engaging in private activities and then just goes back to New York City and just thinks, I'll write about that someday. Mm-hmm. I don't think that – I wouldn't be able to know that that hotel was in operation in that form or fashion for 30 years and not do something about it.
Yeah. Yeah, it does seem – that seems troubling. So you never had him on LiveWire then to talk about this particular thing?
I don't think so. Okay, yeah. It'd be weird if that happened and I forgot about it.
No, I don't think you did. Possible. I feel like you were maybe trying to get him on or something, and then I think it became impossible for him maybe to do interviews because of the blowback or, I don't know, something like that.
Yeah, I was definitely, let's see. By the way, October 1st, 2009, Gay Talese on Sinatra Journalism and how the New York Times used to be staffed by total drunks. Were we still a radio show at that point?
2009. What is the month?
October of 2009. We would have still been a radio show.
Really? Is that when did you get?
No, maybe not.
I don't think so. Well, you would know them. What fired. Month did you get fired? What was the weather like?
I don't remember.
Was it rainy?
It wasn't rainy inside the nightlight, which is where I went.
Oh, I missed the nightlight.
R.I.P. the nightlight. Anyway, I do think that Voyeur is a very interesting documentary and raises a lot of interesting questions. And like I said, doesn't paint, as you would say, doesn't really paint Gay Talese in glory necessarily. It shows him to be much more insecure than I would have expected, like considering his body of work. I guess I shouldn't be surprised that people who are very successful are also massively insecure. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's actually kind of obvious. But, I mean, the guy is such a legend that you would just think that he would feel like my legacy is set. But he is so upset and freaked out by the fact that this is all being called into question. He's just like, I'm over. My career is done. I'm going to be remembered as a liar. Like, he's really, 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 really fragile and frail and kind of, you know, affected by this, where I would think at that. And he also saves everything. Like, the cool part about the movie, too, is you go into like Gay Talese's bunker, basically in the basement of his house in New York, where he's just got every article that's ever been written about him. He has it saved, which is like not a thing that non-insecure people do.
Yeah, right.
Did I get too many double negatives in there?
It's why didn't I mean? Now I'm just asking you to tell me the story of this. I should just watch the documentary, but I don't get it. Like, why? How does somebody with his journalism background make a mistake like this? Like,
I think
fact checkers.
Well, that was what was really weird. So, not to get whatever we can at this point, we can get down into the granular details because I think we've chased off most of the listeners. Yeah, so the big first hurdle for the story is the New Yorker fact-checking department. And what's weird is, so the New Yorker fact-checking department figures out that this guy, Foos, did not own the hotel as early as he stated he did. He said he had it in 1966. He didn't get it till 1969. Why does that matter? Because he has this very, very detailed log of every room and everybody who stayed there, what their ethnicity was, if they were employed, what they did while they were in the room. And he's got them from 1969. Which is, he didn't own the hotel. Like, the deed on the hotel, you know, very clearly shows he didn't own the hotel at that point. So there's no
but
way
he's got
he
them. For, you said
there.
he has them from 69. You mean he has them going back to 66, right? Okay.
Exactly. Gotcha. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. He's got them. He's got these detailed things from a time where he didn't actually own the motel. So that's immediately like a red flag. And Gaetelice, I think Gaetelice, the New Yorker identifies, but you could see that Gaetelice has so much invested in this story. He's been talking to this guy for 30 years. He has, you know, he's seen with his own eyes this catwalk that's been built, that I think he just kind of like, he's like, well, whatever, the details are the details, but the core issue is this thing exists, I've been on it. And that just pushes him through any question or doubt. And then what happens is somehow it escapes the New Yorker's fact checkers that this dude had then also sold the motel way earlier than anyone thought. That's what really, really torpedoed the book, was that he basically sold the motel to his friend and didn't even own it for a number of years that he's keeping these notes. Now, his argument was, my friend was also a pervert and he would just let me come and go. And so I was still doing all of my quote unquote observations. But yeah, you'd think that the fact checkers would have caught that part. And again, I think Gaetelice was really just blinded by the fact that this was such a juicy story. He's not young, you know what I mean? Like, he probably felt like this is my last best shot at making a huge impact on the culture with this book, which has been 30 years in the making. And he just desperately didn't want it to not get published or not be popular or not make a mark, because he's probably at 80, whatever he is, he's probably not going to go out and find another story like this and write about it.
I will say, this hotel owner, I guarantee if he finds a USB drive in the parking lot, he is checking it out. I'll bet you he's got a computer that isn't even plugged into the internet just for that purpose.
Here I go once again with the email. Every week I hope that it's from a female. Oh man, it's not from a female.
All right, any emails jumping out at you, my friend?
Well, the one from our friend Lisa in Oceanside, California, whom we spoke with, I believe.
She's the 500 concerts by 50.
That's right. I got an email from her that says, "Your brain is good!" Exclamation point. So when you say, "Does anything catch
really
my
good
eye?"
Way to get your email read.
Yeah,
on the show.
I'll say something caught my eye. Lisa says, "Maybe I should have said you're not insane in the membrane." Sorry, I had to go there. Just want to let you know that you weren't wrong to associate "Jump Around" by House of Pain with Cypress Hill. I had said kind of in passing that I get those two songs confused, even though they're by different bands who are, and they're very, I mean, they're not very similar bands, but there was something about those two songs that always remind me of each other. And Lisa says it was both songs were produced by DJ Muggs of Cypress Hill. Or at least the song "Jump Around" by House of Pain was produced by DJ Muggs of Cypress Hill. And she says, back in my college days, I worked for KXLU, the college station
at
Loyola Marymount. And the Cypress Hill guys used to come by the station semi-regularly shortly before their first record came out. I knew Muggs and Sen and Lewis a little bit and was also happy for them that they did so well. How cool is that? Lisa's just like, she's always, did you say she's like, Zelig, did you say that on the show the other day? Because she does have a Zelig kind of quality to being in the right place,
like
at the right
place,
time.
Right time.
Yeah,
just like walking out of a Lyle Lovett show, and there's Lyle, and then they're friends for life. They start following each other on social.
Mm-hmm.
She knows Cypress Hill guys. I loved KXLU when I lived in LA. I would listen to it a lot, actually, the Loyola Marymount station, because it's like a cool college station. And also, you know, Vanessa went to Loyola Marymount, so she would like hipped me to that as well, I think.
Now, is that a Jesuit school? It must be, right? Loyola? Yeah. Okay, yeah. That makes sense. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
She went to a Jesuit school. Do you want to hear one more story here?
I do.
This is a good one. This is from Marshall in San Francisco. Marshall says, I have a garbage problem, and I need to speak with you right away. This just happened 5 minutes ago.
I'm the president of garbage problems, and I need to speak with you right away.
I live in a ground floor apartment in San Francisco. My bedroom looks into our four-unit building's driveway. So living in a four-unit building, bedroom window faces the driveway for all of these units. With the cars and the garbage cans in the driveway. I can see out of my window well, but someone outside can't see in that well. So I watched a guy walk up. Again, this was 5 minutes ago as Marshall writes this. I just watched a guy walk up, look from side to side, and then brazenly deposit 7 or 8 full dog poop bags into our building's single garbage can, which is easily accessible from the sidewalk. This seemed quite odd. His dog was not with him. Why did he have 8 poop bags ready to throw out with him? Maybe he was on a road trip and just had all these bags sitting in his car. So I walk up to the front of my apartment and I open the front door and I just watch him walk away while I'm glaring at him from behind. And I see him walk up the stairs into this really nice apartment building that's across the street, about 5 houses down. I don't even have that much garbage anxiety normally, but this situation is like a premeditated crime. Why did he walk all that way from his building where he had clearly already put his dog poop inside and then throw his poop bags into our trash? I kind of want to take them out and go put them on his porch. What are your thoughts? What would you do? Garbage day. It's Thursday morning. I think I got this over the weekend. Now, I didn't respond to that because I didn't see it, and I see that I got an update from Marshall. He says, I put this hand-drawn sign on his front door, and this is an amazing – I'll make it today's show pick. It's an amazing hand-drawn sign on, like, ruled notebook paper that says, I know what you did last night in really nice hand – in, like, very clear handwriting, and then Marshall drew a perfect approximation of the poop emoji. This thing is art, and he stuck it to this guy's door.
I love it. Can you send it to me?
Yes.
I don't know how. I'm not. Was this sent to the our TBTL email accounts? I guess I wasn't on the list. I wasn't invited to this email.
Yeah, I will. I'll try to send it to you now.
People know that if they're going to do a garbage, if they're going to talk about garbage anxiety, they know who to go to on this show.
That's right. We do have our beats. So I'm trying to get into my email. I had copied and pasted that, so I will try to get this to you as soon as
possible.
That's
amazing. I wonder what, because if I'm following the story right, this person was basically lives in a different apartment building, but they did not want to. What they basically decided was, I don't want to throw my dog's poop into my apartment building's trash because then I will probably have to continue dealing with it, smelling it, interacting with it, or my other hoity-toity neighbors will. This is for the hoi polloi. This is for steerage, for the apartment across the street. We'll dump it over there, and then it won't be our problem. I mean, that's just a metaphor for everything that the wealthy do in this country.
That's right, yeah. And they walked down the street about five houses down, apparently.
Jeez. Marshall, please keep us posted on I guess the only other thing you could do in addition to that, it would be to, I would be shocked if that person ever comes back to Marshall's garbage can, right?
Yeah, that's a good point. It definitely probably did the trick.
But if it doesn't, what you could also do is you could just make a similar sign or something and put it on the garbage can at your work or at your home or your building, which is basically like, if you don't live here, don't put anything in this can. We're watching you or something.
Yeah.
You could really put the fear of God in this person.
Put some googly eyes on the can. Just says, I'm watching you. Boy, I sent you the photo. I downloaded that photo
and
sent it to you, but I am amazed at there. I can't tell if it's GoDaddy, if it's me, or if it's that perfect combination of GoDaddy and me. I find it impossible to find things. Once, like, I probably read this email and then copied and pasted into my email document and then deleted it, but it's not in the in my trash folder anywhere. I see his original email before the follow up with the drawing on it, and I know Marshall's name. I know everything to be able to find this, but GoDaddy is saying that the email that I just read does not exist. Anyway, not
it. It also doesn't help when we're trying to do it quote unquote live on the air.
Sure,
I know that, like, when I'm looking for something in the moment, there is this ticking clock in my head of like, I'm losing everyone. This is so boring, me like hunting around. And then it's probably been 5 seconds, but it feels like a very long 5 seconds. So then I just panic.
Yeah, but I mean, you've bought me a lot of time. I have sent you. Oh, there it is. I found the original one. Sorry, GoDaddy. This one was on me. You're a good GoDaddy.
Ugh. How about no daddy?
No
daddy.
That?
How about that? I will say that this poop emoji that Marshall drew that I'm now looking at.
Pretty good.
This, it's very good. No, you're right. It's exactly like the real emoji. I'm just almost wondering. And maybe this was the intention. It's kind of, this is a sort of a friendly, this is sort of a slight reprimand, but with a wink and a little bit of a wink, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I mean, it's like
it's not
emojis.
Just full on, like, don't effing put your dog poop in our garbage.
Yeah.
It's more like, hey, buddy, I saw what you did. Maybe don't do that anymore. But here's this friendly poop emoji. Like, it's, I almost feel like the person deserved a much stronger reprimand than this, but. Maybe this, I mean, this is probably going to get the job done, and this is probably the right approach instead of escalating.
My only hope is that the right person got this, because if that other person also lives in an apartment building, and maybe it's the wrong unit, or maybe, like, that person lives with another person, and they saw it and thought that somebody was just, you'd have to be kind of a psychopath, though, to find that on your front door and not mention it to some, like, to throw it away and not mention it to the other people you live with, right? Whether it's a roommate situation or a partnership in that house.
I would have written, I know what you did last summer, then drawn the thing from Scream so mm-hmm. that the person would think that their partner had literally killed someone.
Mm-hmm. And you would have written it in blood.
Yeah, obviously.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of blood. Pink blood, but yeah, still sure. Blood nonetheless.
Yeah, I wrote it in pink blood. Did you write down the show titles? We like burned through like two or three good show titles right at the beginning of the show, but I did not write any of them down. I can go back and find them, but did you write them down?
I have Multinational Ball of Confusion.
Oh, that's pretty good. Yeah, we'll go with that.
And then I can't remember the other ones because I didn't write them down.
That's fine. I like that.
Okay. All right. Well, then, I guess that brings us to the end of this little program for a Monday. Thank you very much, everybody, for listening. Thanks for being part of the show. We're going to be back here tomorrow with more Imaginary Radio for you. So please do join us for that. Till then, I hope you're safe and sound wherever you might be and staying as sane as is possible during these still unreasonable times. Wear a mask, everybody. Thank you so much. We'll see you tomorrow. Until then, please remember, no mountain too tall.
And good luck to all.
Power out.